On this week's 51%, we feature a discussion with the author of a book about the criminalization of black girls in school.
What really is at the center of this discussion is how we have come to understand and read the behaviors of black girls such that they are disproportionately negatively impacted by punishment and by punitive policies and practices.
And we have a Women in History spotlight on two notorious women. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
You gotta change all this appearance. Maybe judging one another by their appearance. Yes, India, I feel you, girl. Now go ahead, talk to the rest of the world. Cause the way I wear my hair make me a better person. There's the way I wear my hair make me a better friend. Oh, there's the way I wear my hair determine my integrity.
Monique Morris is the author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in School. She's also the co-founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. 51%'s Bob Barrett spoke with Morris about her book that is a discussion about the experiences of black girls across the country whose lives, Morris says, are misunderstood, highly judged by teachers, administrators, and the justice system, and degraded by the institutions charged with helping them flourish.
How did you get the title? Where does Push Out come from?
Push-out is a term that has been used by advocates to reframe the conditions and the way in which we understand the experiences of young people who have not completed school. Historically, we've used the term dropout, which really does place the sort of focus on the behaviors of the young people rather than exploring the conditions that facilitate a failure to complete school. Push-out calls attention to the policies, practices, and in my work, you know, prevailing consciousness and educational systems that basically push kids out. It's a very literal interpretation that turn children away from school. And in my work and in the exploration of this project, the ways in which that push out then facilitates an increased risk of contact with the criminal legal system.
You spent 4 years looking at girls' stories. Where did you look? Where did these girls come from?
You know, I looked at national data sets for some of this work, and that's really where the research exploration began. Though experientially, I'd been engaged in this work probably, you know, for almost 2 decades, beginning in many ways with my interactions with girls in detention facilities upon the release of my first book in the Bay Area that focused on prostitution. But the narratives in the book actually come from various cities around the country, specifically in the Bay Area, Southern California, New Orleans, Chicago, New York, the Northeast area, and again, pulling narratives from other interactions that I'd had with girls throughout the country. But the strong narratives in the book are included from those cities.
And in such a wide geographic area, what do these girls have in common?
You know, there's a lot that girls have in common, particularly, you know, the black girls that I talked to. I went and prioritized the engagement of girls who had been pushed out. So those, I went straight to those girls who are at the center of our inquiry, those girls who had not completed school, who were in detention facilities, who were under the supervision of the criminal and juvenile legal systems, and overwhelmingly, what these girls had in common was that they had had trouble in schools and that they had failed to have strong student-teacher relationships that could facilitate their well-being in school. They had a centrality. There was a centrality of trauma in their lives, an elevated risk and elevated experience among these girls of having experienced commercial sexual exploitation and other forms of violent victimization. And really, an inability for the adults in their lives to understand, see, and respond to these conditions.
Is there any commonality between the school districts we're talking about, or is this just different problems for different areas?
You know, I talked to them about that, and I think there are some things that are absolutely geographically different and that we have to acknowledge as some of the conditions that are different. In terms of whether the school uses corporal punishment, for example, or whether the school is a zero-tolerance school or a district that overwhelmingly believes that zero-tolerance policies are the appropriate way to respond to the conditions of girls who are behaving in ways that are problematic in schools versus those that don't and have restorative or alternative continua to respond to negative student behavior. And you know, overwhelmingly, I think what is uniform in all of these conditions and why I frame this conversation the way I do is that in some ways, it does absolutely matter whether you have these conditions in place, but what really is at the center of this discussion is how we have come to understand and read the behaviors of Black girls such that they are disproportionately negatively impacted by punishment and by punitive policies and practices in response to their behaviors. Kids get in trouble in every school. Kids get in trouble and make mistakes and have to have an opportunity to learn from those mistakes. But the schools where there is a heightened priority around punishment and exclusion, so the use of expulsions and suspensions to respond to negative student behavior, those are the schools that produce girls who don't complete school at the same rates as others. Those are the places where kids in general, and particularly Black girls, experience heightened rates of violent victimization in school as well as out. So part of what you know I want us to think about are the ways in which the national trends around discipline, the condition that Black girls are living with, where they are 16% of the percent of girls in schools, but they are overwhelmingly represented, and the only group of girls that are represented or overrepresented in all categories for which data are collected on discipline by the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights. So, you know, when we look at these trends around discipline and then we look at the layer around our understanding of their behaviors and how we've constructed identities for them that support or justify our use of exclusionary discipline, then I think we start to understand how, in many ways, it doesn't matter where you are in this country, that Black girls are uniquely and in many ways uniformly impacted by the misperceptions that guide adult decision-making and the differential implementation of various policies in ways that render them more vulnerable to exclusion from school.
Have you seen anything that just points out the difference between the way that Black girls are treated rather than girls are treated?
Other girls?
Yeah.
You know, some of the narratives that I find most stark in the book are around dress code policies, because we don't tend to think about dress code policies as a practice that can exclude girls from school or that can turn children away from school in a way that can facilitate their failure to complete school. But in my discussions with Black girls, they do perceive and describe with great detail the ways in which administrators and other personnel on school campuses have turned them away for wearing the exact same clothing as a white or Asian counterpart. You know, for one example, a girl arrived in short shorts because it was a hot day, and when she arrived in the shorts, she was told she had to go home and change, and she watched a girl come in who, in her opinion, wasn't even as physically developed as she was, who was more physically developed than she was, and the administrator looked at her and said, "I'm sorry, she can go to class, you can't, because it looks different on your body." And for her and for many other Black girls that I've spoken with, this is actually an issue where, you know, in conversations with girls, they really do come alive in this space because they can perceive and feel the differential impact of these policies and the ways in which the adults in their lives are policing not their clothing but their bodies in these spaces of learning and really placing a prioritization on how they present in schools rather than them being there to learn. And so in many ways, girls, and particularly some of the girls who I profile in Push Out, you know, really begin to share their resistance to these ideas and the punishment that comes when they do resist against this form of misreading or misperception and what they view and what I consider to be oppression.
We've heard stories recently, and in fact, you write about it here, about the school-to-prison pipeline. You mostly hear about boys in that. Are girls caught up in that, too?
There's no question that girls are impacted by this, and And I actually stay away from the term school-to-prison pipeline as much as I can, because in our consciousness, in our public discussions about this issue, we've masculinized that idea. We think about the school-to-prison pipeline, and we immediately think about young people, mostly boys, who are arrested on campus or who are somehow, come into contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system on campus in ways that can facilitate their increased risk of incarceration or, prison. And yet what I was finding in that conversation about school-to-prison pipeline is that it was a very linear way to describe, to describe the phenomenon. And I think that it's an urgent call to action for sure. And so it has a place in our discussion. But when we're talking about girls, I think it's really important for us to explore the multiple pathways that facilitate criminalization, which is a broader issue than just incarceration, and to recognize that for girls, we're talking about children who are largely not going to be in prison, that they are going to experience other forms of confinement. They may experience, GPS monitoring or informal probation or detention or placement in residential facilities, and that there's a full continuum of confinement options in our juvenile legal system that we often don't name, and so we don't see it. And so my way of engaging with this work is to approach this concept of criminalization by looking at school-to-confinement pathways and to honor and recognize that it's a very dynamic process, not a linear one. Girls are, education is a critical protective factor against contact with the juvenile and criminal legal system in the life of a girl. And so everything that we have been trying to do to reduce risk of contact with the juvenile legal system or reduce contact with prisons or law enforcement, really has to focus on these pathways to really look at the centrality of trauma, as I was saying earlier, the increased risk of sexual and violent victimization in the lives of girls, as well as some of the other dominant misperceptions about black femininity that render them vulnerable to having their behaviors policed in a manner that is consistent with stereotypes as opposed to being consistent with their actual lived experience.
You do talk about black girls' femininity and the way that they are treated. And a lot of the girls you talked to were actually in sex work at a very early age. Is this a growing problem in the African-American community?
It's a longstanding problem in many communities, but it does disproportionately impact black communities. We see that nationally, the reported rates of girls who are involved in commercial sexual exploitation are at about 40% for black girls. But when you look at what's happening in some of our biggest urban centers that are hubs for sex trafficking domestically, we see rates as high as 80 and 90% for participation in these underground economies and in the commercial sexual exploitation of young people. And it's deeply problematic because in many of our discourses about this issue, we tend to think about sex trafficking as a global phenomenon. And when we see girls on the street domestically, there's a rhetoric around them or used to describe their condition as them choosing to participate in the life. And to me, that framework is deeply problematic and does not reflect the lived experience or the reality that these girls are being habitually raped and sexually exploited. That no one chooses as a child to be in this space, and arguably doesn't even choose as an adult, given it's really about the conditions in their lives. But I call attention to that here because, again, when we talk about the girls who are in contact with the juvenile legal system and the type of criminalization that occurs in the lives of girls, what we've got to do is step backwards and look at what has been happening to them, what has happened in their lives. And many of the girls that we count in our data sets as truant or that we see fighting, these are girls who have experienced commercial sexual exploitation, whether they want to be labeled as a CSEC, which is the acronym we use for commercially sexually exploited child. If they want to be labeled in that way is one thing. That may be inconsistent with their lived experience of actually having felt that they were or having participated in some way in the sex trade. And so, you know, as girls, you know, it's a really important issue for me and for us to explore in the education domain, because these girls are not able to come to school. In some cases, girls describe not being able to come to school because of a decision that was not made by them, but by the person who was exploiting them and their pimps. They are, you know, sort of, there's a power dynamic here at play that our institutions don't acknowledge. And if our institutions are seeing someone who's at risk of being commercially sexually exploited, they often don't report it as they should as an incident of child abuse. And so it's, you know, we've got to get better at responding to the needs of our girls, but also recognizing them as experiencing this kind of trauma and victimization, as opposed to just writing off their behaviors as problematic and suspending or expelling them. All that does is place them out on the street. And so the use of exclusionary discipline is very problematic as we think about it in terms of responding to the negative conditions or the negative behaviors that are manifesting in the classroom. And so the greater opportunities we have to improve the kind of wraparound services in schools, the partnerships, the therapists, counselors, et cetera, that have absolutely a place in schools, arguably more so than police in schools, you know, it's really important for us to think through these things more critically, and that's what I'm calling attention to.
Is there anything I didn't ask that you want everyone to know?
The one thing I'll say, you know, is that I talk in broad terms about Black girls in this project, but I do want to acknowledge that. And I do acknowledge this in the book that, you know, Black is a large umbrella term to reflect the experiences of a very diverse group of people. There are narratives included in the book from Black Latinas, as I was saying, or girls who identify as Black biracial, as well as girls who are African American or who consider themselves to be all African American, and Black trans girls who have particular experiences around gender identity and expression, but that, you know, it's important for us in our exploration of this issue to understand that there is no one way to be a Black girl, and there's no one way to be anything, that we're all living our lives as unique individuals, and so structures and policies that are in place to criminalize their behaviors because they don't align with our expectations for what a good girl should be need to be interrogated. And these are places where we can begin this kind of engagement.
That was Monique Morris, author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in School, speaking with 51%'s Bob Barrett. Now we move to what history has pegged as women who behaved rather badly. Gilles Malkin closes our show with an edition of Women in History, in which he profiles two women of notoriety, a pirate and a serial killer.
You've undoubtedly heard the saying to the effect that anything a man can do, a woman can do better. It follows, then, that if this includes the noblest pursuits and highest achievements, it may also include the worst possible behavior. Here are two illustrations of this. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, says another saying, and this adage is personified by a woman of the olden days named Jeanne de Belleville, or Jeanne de Clisson, as she was later known, who lived in Brittany back in the day when it was a separate duchy from the rest of France. This wife of an unfortunate Breton nobleman saw her husband's head stuck on a pike by order of Philippe VI, King of France, in 1343. Said husband had supposedly helped to defend France against the English, but was suspected of having played both sides, and so was invited to a tournament at the French court, at the occasion of which he was captured and beheaded without the bothersome delay of any legal process. Jeanne saw red. She would be avenged. She assembled some of the faithful lords of Brittany. They attacked and thoroughly depopulated two castles held by the French. She sold all her lands and possessions and, with the assistance of Edward III, King of England, invested in three warships, painted black and outfitted with blood-red sails, by means of which she roamed the English Channel hunting for French commercial vessels. She stopped every one of them she found and totally massacred their crews. Her style, however, was always to leave one or two souls to go free in order to inform the King of France, in detail, of every French citizen's body that had been disencumbered of its head, in memory of the similar fate that he had perpetrated upon her husband. There are no accurate records to chronicle the exact number of her victims over the next 10 years, but her enterprise was successful enough to make her known as the Tigress of Brittany, famous for her single-minded mercilessness and savagery, up till then a domain unfairly dominated by men. She then retired to the protection of the English king and lived peacefully on the coast of her Brittany until her death in 1359. Countess Elizabeth Báthory, born in 1560 in Hungary into a rich and influential family, is believed today to be the bloodiest and most diabolical serial killer ever, bar none. On the surface, she was very intelligent, very well educated, and very wealthy, and she ran a sophisticated court that lorded over 10 castles and their lands, which she controlled in the absence of her soldiering husband. But how she dispensed of her servant girls is reputed to have revealed a penchant for extreme cruelty and rage. Some believe that she tortured, bled, maimed, and mutilated and killed over 600 girls from the surrounding peasantry, most of them workers at the castle. It was rumored that her attraction to the rejuvenating properties of blood led her to drain this substance from her servant girls at the slightest provocation. It was not unusual at that time for the rich to treat the help as chattel, if one can believe that, and to take out their frustrations by inflicting great inconveniences upon them. Wild imaginations and the passing of time may have had a role in stoking the reality, whatever it may have been, into a legend of the most gruesome sort. Save the fact that the bodies of young women being buried were climbing into the unusually large numbers, it is true that concrete evidence is scant. But the conspicuous lack of official documents one would expect to find documenting this highly sordid affair carries some weight as well. It's been postulated that the Countess was simply trying out her talent for the medicinal arts, which resulted in many unfortunate failures. If there's any truth to this, her successes in this field are even more remarkably absent from local records and testimony. For many years, nothing was done about the rumors of the girl's bloody fates. The Hungarian Emperor Matthias II owed Elizabeth's family a great deal of money, which he had borrowed to help fight the Turks. But in 1610, finally responding to years of complaints from a local Lutheran minister named Magyari and others, concerning the disappearance of many local girls, the emperor finally sent a royal contingent to investigate. Many of her servants were interrogated, not so gently, and 4 were executed. Their testimonies indicated that 30 to 50 women had been Elizabeth's victims. However, the number 600 has been proffered as just as likely. The lack of any trial and the smoothness with which her lands were passed directly to relatives after her death implies a deal of some sort had a higher prominence in deciding her fate than did her crimes. Elizabeth herself, by canceling the emperor's debt, escaped punishment in lieu of house arrest until her death in 1614. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Writer, composer, and actor Gilles Malkin is a resident of the Catskills region of New York. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1409.